This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 90. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. I'm Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, both brand new photographers who are shooting with an iPhone or their brand new DSLR, as well as many seasoned professionals and very experienced photographers. We just have a wide array of photographers that support Improve Photography and listen to the show. To talk about today's topics, where we're going to talk a lot about news and also some cool tips that I learned about nature photography recently, I am joined by my friend, Darren Meller.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well. I've been shooting a lot lately, and I know you have too. I've been watching your photos. I saw a shoot you did of some horses running around that looked really cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. We were shooting in the magic hour, and my friend posted on with her iPhone a picture of some horses on Instagram, and I said, "Where is this?" And it looked like a really surreal environment, and luckily the owner was very friendly, and she just said, "Yeah, if you don't mind stepping in some horse droppings, come on out here." And my dog had a blast running through there, rolling in the horse droppings herself, which that made another fun story.
But... And you're like, "Horse droppings, count me in."
Yeah, exactly. But it was so worth it because I was able to try my wide-angle lens for certain different types of shots to include the dog chasing the horses like she was a big, massive dog, even though she's a lot smaller than what she thinks she is. And then also we had this nice, beautiful orange light coming through the trees and casting nice highlights on the horses' manes and just different areas. And it just was a perfect timing for doing it. It reminded me a lot of portraiture photography, of making sure that the lighting, especially your available light, was key. And I'm kind of turning into a light snob the more that I shoot, but I love the fact that these turned out so well. So, I mean, it was definitely out of my comfort zone, but I'm happy I did the shoot.
That's awesome. And the results were really cool. That was really, really nice work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, in the last episode, we talked about some of the shoots that I did recently with portraiture, and today we want to talk about the Improve Photography Travel Group's recent expedition to West Virginia in the United States. I was joined by a small group. I think we had, six of us on the shoot, and just a small group, and we just had so much fun shooting. And also, I shot in Portland last week, shooting landscapes and nature photography, so... In this episode, I kind of just want to share some of the little tips, just little things that I noticed as I was shooting. I feel like, you know, we want to learn as much of the book knowledge of photography as possible, for sure. But at the same time, the best thing that you can do with your photography is just to gain experience. And so the best we can do on a podcast is to just share what we're learning as we go, you know, to make it as much like as if you were sitting there shooting next to us as possible and sharing those tips that we're learning. So let's talk about it. The first tip that I realized, especially on this trip, was using the importance of using a polarizer whenever you're shooting when there's foliage. So a polarizer, usually we think of it when we're shooting water to take the reflection off, or we think of it to darken a blue sky to make the white clouds pop and look nice and bright and clean. But it works very, very well to take the reflection off leaves. So in fall color, even if it's a foggy day, there are highlights on the leaves from, you know, where the sun is. Even if it's an overcast day, there are still highlights on the top of the leaves. And if you don't cut that reflection off with a polarizer, there are just tons of little white spots that could be color instead of that white highlight. And so I found by using a polarizer, I got much more rich, beautiful colors. So be sure to bring that polarizer in the bag, even if it's not one of those classic cut the reflection on the water kind of situations.
Yeah, I always have one in my gear bag. And then for other situations, I know we can get away with not using some of the other filters out there, but I think the two most important ones are your polarizer and your neutral density, because there's just certain situations when you get somewhere and you just wish that you could get that nice, wispy, silky looking water, and if you don't have magic lantern on the Canon or your ISO won't go below 100 and you're maxing it out at f22, it's just nice to have that neutral density filter on there as well, just to slow down the water and the shutter speed, just so it has that nice, wispy, silky feel.
It is. And a quick note about that, with the Nikon D810 that I've been shooting until I destroyed it, so I'm sending it in for repair, is on the D810, the base ISO is 64. Now, I'm not talking about the interpolated ISOs. I'm talking about the base. So usually on a camera, your ISO, your base ISO is 100. Some of the older cameras, it was 200. But the D810 did something very unique in dropping it to 64. Now, below ISO 64, you, of course, have the interpolated ISOs. That's where it might show low 1, low 2, low 3, or high 1, high 2, high 3 that you'll see on your camera on the high end of ISO. Now, what that's doing is the sensor doesn't really have that ISO, but the camera's just pretending it does and using the software to render what it would be otherwise. So I rarely use those interpolated ISOs, but I have found that it's kind of nice. Like, not essential, not something to upgrade a camera for, but it's kind of nice to have that lower base ISO on the Nikon D810 to go to 64, because a lot of times when I'm shooting a waterfall and I want that longer exposure where it's the morning and usually where I'd have to start putting on the filters, I found that I could still shoot for another half an hour because by lowering, you know, to ISO 64, I was cutting out enough light and I could get my long shutter speed still.
That's awesome. If I didn't have a bunch of money invested in Canon lenses, I might have jumped over to Nikon after hearing that.
Yeah, it is helpful for landscape photographers, that's for sure. Well, shooting the fall color was really fun, but it was very hard to time the fall color. I looked at photos from previous years of Portland and West Virginia and Boise, the three locations where I shot fall color in the last couple weeks, and I tried to time it looking at previous photos on Flickr and 500px and Pixoto, trying to decide when the color would turn, but it's always a guessing game. And I was too early in Portland for the color in most of the spots, and I was too late for the color in West Virginia of what most people would consider peak color. But I learned something just really cool on the shoot in West Virginia. So as soon as we all showed up and I met with the travel group, the travel group is our free workshop series that we just going out and shooting with other photographers who listen to the website. Anybody is welcome to attend. And I have a new spot on the website at improvephotography.com/travel group. And that's where you can see the upcoming travel group events that we're doing. Anybody's welcome to join us, and totally free. Just pay your own travel expenses. We just get together, you know, eat together at restaurants, go shoot, share photos together, you know, say, hey, I'm having trouble with this, or, you know, come grab me during the shoot and say, hey, you know, I'd love a little portfolio review. What can I do? And it's just a really neat experience. But I was shooting with these photographers, and as soon as we got there, we all kind of realized it was past peak. We were a little bit late. A lot of the leaves had just kind of turned to a kind of a dull orange and had fallen off the trees onto the ground, or were just kind of hanging onto the tree, but they were just that crinkly, dry orange leaf, you know, the kind of dead leaf. And at first, the first night I shot, and I thought, oh man, you know, we kind of missed it here. And then I took the photos back to the hotel, and we were post-processing in the lobby all together. And I tried some techniques to see if I could pull out that color a little bit better. So, you know, I tried cranking the vibrance and saturation. It just looked bad. And so I went into the HSL panel. That's the highlight saturation or the hue saturation and luminance. And under the hue panel, I thought, this would be interesting. What if I grab the color from those crinkly dead leaves and I make that crinkly dead color turn into a red and I leave all the other colors the same? And suddenly, I mean, just immediately the landscape changed into this beautiful, incredible, unbelievable fall color landscape, because those dead leaves suddenly turned beautiful. And it turned out that we were actually there at the perfect time of year, because we could use those dead leaves and make them look beautiful red. And the ones that had fallen on the ground made just this unbelievable carpet of beautiful color of leaves, where normally when you're shooting fall color, everything's still on the trees, you know, there's not those leaves on the ground yet. So as it turned out, it was just unbelievable the color we were getting. And this is where you all come in. I am working on a new set of presets. I have been all year long. Last year, I did my Lightroom Steel, and it was a big success. I've just heard so much feedback from many of you that you've just been loving the Lightroom presets from last year. And that's motivated me to really take it to the next level and create a new set based on kind of the, some of the newer styles like matte that a lot of people are doing with portraits this year, but also new things that I'm learning. Like with this shoot where I saw that, so I've created a couple Lightroom presets that's using exactly this technique. So when you shoot fall color, you just bang, one click, and it's incredible. I mean, just unbelievable how it transformed these landscapes. I was just really, really happy with it.
I'm happy that you're giving away the secret sauce to this. I was just wondering what that secret sauce was behind the photo. And now it's just really awesome to hear that it's going to be part of an updated preset. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard a few people mention to me, say, you know, why are you offering presets? You can make presets yourself. And I think, Yeah, you can and you should. Everybody should be making presets. I think presets are awesome. I love making them for myself. But I'm learning a ton. I'm shooting photography full time. And so, you know, a preset is not just styles that you just throw out there. You know, you're learning things and implementing different techniques for specific situations. And so I buy presets from other photographers too, because when I see somebody getting lots of experience and thinking of cool new looks, I want to see what they're doing. And the cool thing about a Lightroom preset is it's one click and bang, it applies the style to your photo. But then you can go through all the sliders and see exactly what they did to get to that style. It's not hidden in any way. And so you get the experience of kind of seeing the way that other photographers are approaching it. And it really, really helps with your post-processing. But I digress. Anyway, we had an awesome shoot in West Virginia. It was so cool.
And I do have to add one thing to your presets, and it's very helpful too, because none of it's hidden. Like, for instance, I've used the graduated filter with the temperature adjustment tool to put a little sun flare on those horse pictures that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I learned that from your, the warm frost preset that you had in the last rendition of them?
Yeah.
Yep. And I learned how to do that through those presets. So really, it's none of that's hidden, and it teaches you how to work on things in a pinch. For instance, right now, my Lightroom catalog that I'm running on my laptop doesn't have those presets built into it. So I had to go through that process of kind of being a MacGyver of sorts and went ahead and put the warm light in there, just similar to how you did with your presets. So it's a really awesome learning tool.
Yeah, it is. And the presets, I should say, so we don't get a million questions, are going to be available on Black Friday of this year. So in a month, in the end of November, for those of you who don't do the Black Friday like we do in the United States. So at the end of November, they're going to be available. I'm going to honor that same price of last year. It was a little bit crazy, but I am still going to do that $40 price from last year. And I know you're going to love it. We're going to call this one the 2015 Lightroom Steel, because we're kind of like a car company. You know how they always introduce the new cars of the year coming up. Anyway, we'll call it the 2015 Lightroom Steel, so you know that it's a new set and not that same set from last year.
That's awesome.
Well, it was so fun shooting with the people that I was able to meet up with in West Virginia. The first day that we met up, we shot there, and after we saw that trick in Lightroom, then the next day there was fog, and I had looked at the weather. I was hoping that there was fog. I was telling them the night before. I said, I hope that there's some fog in the morning, and the weather saw that there might be a little bit. And we went out to a bridge called the New River Gorge Bridge in West Virginia. And it's a huge, huge bridge over a gorge. And the fall color underneath it is just fantastic underneath this bridge. And so we got there before light, and as soon as we walked in there, all of us were just so excited, because we saw just this perfect, like, you couldn't have painted it more perfect, just this perfect little strip of fog flowing down the river and going underneath this bridge. It was just crazy. So you could see the river below, gorgeous fall color, this perfect, unbelievable tunnel of fog going over this arched bridge. It was just off the hook, incredible, awesome, awesome shoot. What I learned there is, I was shooting blind because I had to shoot on my backup camera because all my camera died right before I was leaving. And so as soon as I saw the fog, I was shooting an aperture priority, and I dialed in negative 0.3 of exposure compensation. And or a third of a stop of exposure compensation, because when the camera sees all that white of the fog, it says, whoa, it's really bright out here. But it's not. It's just a white fog. And so I knew that the camera was going to get messed up on that. So I just dialed it down minus 1/3 of a stop, and the exposures turned out just perfect. Another thing that I realized about halfway through the shoot is that when it was dark when we started shooting, I was shooting, 15 second exposures because it was really dark out there. And I realized, the wind is blowing and this fog is blowing through pretty quick. If I use a 15 second exposure, it's just going to make a huge, ugly white streak through the photo. I need to use a pretty short shutter speed, maybe 1/50th of a second, to be able to freeze that fog so you can see the detail in it and not just like a streak of ugly white going through the photo.
That sounds, that's what I would have done too when shooting blind. Also, when I was over photographing the Kate Shelley High Bridge in central Iowa, I did a similar thing, but I just shot one stop underexposed because the camera kept reading it being so bright. And I had the ability to chimp and look at the back of the camera and just see that it was this white blob. But I stepped it down to about one stop to about 0.3. So it worked out well. You just have to make sure that you're looking at the whole picture and figuring out what the camera is metering. And you don't want the camera to get confused and think, oh shoot, we need to make this really bright and we need to make this really dark, and then you get home with a photo that is just subpar. So that's an awesome thing to do, especially when shooting blind. Bravo to you on that one, Jim.
Yeah, well, I was glad I thought of it because the photo just turned out really cool. It would be hard not to. It was just a gorgeous, gorgeous location. I uploaded it on Pixoto, and it's my second highest rated photo of all time on Pixoto, which I was excited about. It was just so cool. It was just a really, really fun shoot and great people that I got to share it with. But the main thing that you go to West Virginia to shoot at this time of the year is the grist mill. It's a very popular location. Tons of photographers go and shoot it. And it's an old mill there with a beautiful old wooden building. And then a small, it's a waterfall, but it's more of a, kind of a cascade underneath it. And I tried a lot of different photos in the area. It's kind of tough to cut the sky out of the shot, that was just white with fog, really. And so I was trying to just cut out the sky as much as possible and just have trees and waterfall. And that one turned out really well. That's my highest rated on Pixoto. And so in one day, I got my two highest rated photos of all time, which I was really excited about. I'm a numbers guy. I guess I'm kind of overly competitive. I know that, Pixoto isn't the end all be all in photography. It's art, it's subjective, it's what you like, but that doesn't mean that I don't really like it. And so that was really fun to shoot.
Yeah. And I think that it's a great resource, and I'll have to link people over to your Pixoto profile just to see, because I was blown away with how many 700 plus images do you have on there with the rating? I'm a numbers guy too, but I stopped competing with you quite a while ago.
No. I think I'm about 8 or 9, maybe 10 photos that I have in 700s, but next year I'm working for an 800. I want to see if I can do it. It's so competitive. So the way that Pixoto works, if you haven't used it, it's a free website, and both Darren and I we really like it a lot. What it is, you submit a photo, and then you have other photographers that it'll show two photos on their screen, and they just click on which one they prefer. So your photo, may get 10, maybe 100 challenges from other photographers, and the better the photo is, the more challenges it puts it in. So it's pretty accurate, because a lot of photographers are rating your photo on what they think. And the other thing that's cool about it is, unlike 500pix or other websites, it doesn't matter if you're popular online. If you have 1 million people that follow your photo blog or 0, you have just as good of a chance of scoring high, because everybody has to vote on the other photos, and you don't see whose photo you're voting on. So it's pretty neat in that way. It's a really helpful tool.
Yeah, I need to get back on the wagon and start putting some photos up there.
Yeah. So to get a 700 score on Pixoto, you have to be the best photo out of 100 pictures. And then around the 750 mark is where you're the best photo out of 100,000 photos, or out of 10,000 photos. And then an 800 is where you're the best photo out of 100,000, and that's the pinnacle. So I haven't hit that. I'm hoping to get that at some point, but not yet, not good enough yet. But anyway, it was fun, and I love using Pixodo as a tool too. Sometimes I'll upload two photos with different post-processing and kind of see which one people prefer. It's really, really neat. But before we go on, lots more tips that we have to share that that we learned in this shoot. We want to take just a second and thank our sponsor for this episode. Our advertiser for this episode is Swirl, S-W-O-R-L. Swirl is a free app available for the iPhone, and you download the app, and then you can pick any of your photos, and with just a couple clicks, you can order a really nicely done photo in a nice frame, and it ships right to your door, you know, wrapped up, looks beautiful, the way that they wrap it in gift wrap, and it's just really fun, because in the film days, we all printed a ton because you would have to print your photo to see it, you know. But now with digital, we, you know, spend so much time on Facebook and putting our photos online that you forget how nice it is to just have family photos around the house or even your professional photography. But even just family photos, I went on Swirl and I printed in just seconds. I was surprised at how quick it was. A photo of me and my kids, and I just set it on my desk where you can also get them for your wall. And it's nicely framed, comes right to you. I really have been liking Swirl. You can get 20% off your order by using the promo code IMPROVE at their website, which is getswirl.com. Or you can go to the show notes at improvephotography.com/90, and we'll have the link right there. All right, so I learned a ton there shooting with the travel group. Two other notes that I want to make about lenses. The first is about focus breathing. I have been shooting a little bit longer of focal length in my landscapes. I haven't gotten up to the 70 to 200 like Michael Fry uses that he told us about on the podcast, but I have been shooting a lot more landscapes using the 24 to 70. I use my wide angle a lot of times, but you know, I found just a lot of situations to use that 24 to 70 recently. And I do not like the Nikon 24 to 70. Most people love it. Optically, it's a great lens. It's sharp. It's a great lens optically, but using it is a pain in the neck. And I don't think it's worth $2,000 that they charge for it. I'm interested to see the Tamron 24 to 70. Aren't you getting that, Darren?
Actually, my dad just picked it up, and he was down in Kansas City doing a consulting thing. He's on his way up and took some photos down there, and I can't wait to see what it comes back at, because he bought it. It was about $1,300, and I think that it's a great savings, and it's also f/2.8, and they also put image stabilization in it too, which also is that nice peace of mind when, you know, you can't possibly shoot over your focal length to avoid any image shake.
Yeah, that is really nice, and that's something that the Nikon doesn't have. So let's look at this. Nikon 24 to 70. It's almost $2,000. It's not internal focus. It's not internal zoom. It has terrible focus breathing. That's the other thing I want to talk about. And it costs almost $2,000. I really am not excited about the Nikon 24 to 70. I never have been. The Canon 24 to 70 is a much better lens. I'm very anxious to see the Tamron. And again, there's nothing wrong with the image quality on the Nikon. That's why so many people like it, is that. But I found that especially when shooting it for landscapes or macro, there's some real limitations to it. So let's talk about the focus breathing. This is where it gets kind of geeky, but if you shoot landscapes, you're going to understand what a big deal this really is. With landscapes, the composition is the deal. Like if you get an awesome composition, you got the photo. So, you know, you lock down on your tripod, you adjust a little bit up, a little bit down, zoom in just slightly, get everything just perfect. And then you want to perfect your focus. Once you get it, you decide where to focus to get your maximum depth of field. And when you do focus, even using autofocus, it changes the focal length of the lens. You'll see that as you refocus, it zooms in or out. And that's called focus breathing. It's when the focus of the lens also impacts that focal length. And almost all lenses do this to some notable extent. But the 24 to 70 does it a lot. And especially where you're using it in this situation and you're trying to get your composition perfect, it's so annoying, because you get your composition perfect, then you focus and it messes up your composition. So you resume, you reset it, and then you've got to focus again because you changed your zoom. Now, in theory, you shouldn't have to change your focus after you've zoomed. But as we can see with this focus breathing, you do, because it did change that focus just slightly. And so you're just fighting. You focus and it messes it up, and then you zoom and it messes up, and then you focus and it messes up. And if you're trying to get a nice, perfect, perfect composition, it's really tough to do. And so I am in the market for a new 24 to 70 that will not focus breathe nearly as much as the Nikon 24 to 70. I haven't tested the Canon to see what it's like, but I'm interested in seeing what the Tamron can do for me. Maybe I can sell this 24 to 70 and pick up the Tamron.
Yeah, or you can sell your Nikon body and I'll send you a Canon with our Tamron version and we'll go that way. No,
yeah,
I'm just kidding around.
Yeah, maybe we should do that. Well, anyway, that's something that I've really been looking at is I've been noticing more of that focus breathing as I'm trying to get those compositions. And so check out the lenses that you use for landscapes. You may find that it impacts things more than you think it does. All right. Well, lots of lessons that we've learned, but we have a couple news items that we want to talk about, and also a very cool announcement that we have for the Improved Photography Travel Group about a free workshop that we're going to be doing in China. I have been looking online at locations to shoot, and China has always been on my list of places to go. There's this place in kind of central China. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Is it Guilin or something? G-U-I-L-I-N. I don't speak Chinese. And do you know how to say it?
I've been saying Guilin or something like that, and no one's really corrected me, so hopefully one of us is correct.
Something like that. We'll learn that it's completely different. Anyway, it's this place in central China that's just, it's like it hasn't been updated in a century. I mean, it's ancient towns and rice paddies, and the mountains there are just unbelievable. I was showing a picture to Emily, my wife, when I was showing her that I was wanting to go to this place, and she looked at the photo and she said, "Is that even real?" Because the mountains are just this crazy cone shape, just tons of them, just tiny little cone-shaped green mountains everywhere, and it's just beautiful with the river running around. You may have seen photos from other photographers of the cormorant fishermen. These are fishermen that have birds that go out on these bamboo rafts floating down the river. And then the birds go catch a fish and they have the ring around the neck so they can't swallow it. And then they pull the fish out and they fish with these gas lanterns. So it's just these older Chinese men on bamboo rafts holding out this light gas lantern and these beautiful birds. It's just crazy amazing place to shoot, and we are going there, and the trip is going to cost $0.00 at least for the guide. You know, everybody pays their own travel expenses for lodging and airfare and such, but I'm not charging anything at all to go over there and lead up and put the itinerary together and help and give tips on photography. And it's basically a free workshop that we're doing in probably the world's coolest photo location. So excited about it. We're looking for dates on that. Haven't totally settled them, but we're thinking of February 2015. And we have details on that at improvephotography.com/travelgroup, as we do with all the other information.
It's so surreal out there with that stock photography image that you posted on there when you were inkling towards going to China. I was blown away, and so was my dad, and we're definitely on board to join you, so that'll be really cool to have both Jim Harmer, myself there, and my father there, who's a huge inspiration to me and my photography, and we get to do some light hiking, and it's just, it's so surreal. The way those mountains that Jim were describing, they're gorgeous. They're so tall, but the pitch is so steep. They're not, you know, a subtle decline like you'll see like in the Rockies or any other mountains around the country here. They're just so unique, and I can definitely see why Emily thought, gosh, are those real or are those fake? Where are they? So
yeah,
that's awesome.
It looks like one of those, you know, computer generated art kind of things that you've seen before, or something from what was that movie, Avatar? You know, it just looks, yep. You look at it and you say, that can't be a real place. It's just unbelievable. So I'm just so excited to go there. I saw a photo from Trey Ratcliffe that he went there a little while ago, and I think that's what kind of got me started on it, that I saw that and I thought, dang, that is just too cool. I have to go there. And lots of photographers have gone there and shot the cormorant fishermen in that location. But I'm just so excited. I don't think I'm going to be able to sleep for the next few months. It looks cool. And we found a pretty good deal for getting there. I mean, for what the trip is, we think we can get our airfare, lodging, guides, transportation, food, everything, total cost from the United States of about $2,500, probably closer to $3,000. That's an expensive trip, but that's a pretty good deal for what it is, especially where you see photography workshops going to locations at $4,000 and $6,000 for international travel. So we're proud to be offering that as a free service that Improved Photography does. I mean, it's like the highlight of my years, getting together with the travel group and just spending time with you and shooting with you and helping you out and learning things from other photographers as well. It's just so, so, so cool.
It is. And I bet that completely dwarfed the news that Apple released a 27-inch iMac with a 5K display. What are your thoughts on that, Jim?
I have been saying it, and people aren't listening to me. Okay, so this is my first thought when I see this. I mean, it's awesome. It looks so cool. I really want to upgrade to it. But a 5K display is 15.3 megapixels. Woo! 15.3 megapixels is crazy. So if you shoot a $7,000 Nikon D4S or a similarly priced Canon 1DX, you spend $7,000 on your photo, and now it barely even will fill the screen. The photo is so small, you know, 16 megapixels. It barely fills the screen. And so I've been saying that we really have to be careful with choosing those lower megapixel cameras. Yes, it's fine for printing a 20 by 30 print. Yes, it's fine for printing a 16 by 20, even a bigger print. It can be fine. But what about the fact that our computer displays, where we see most photos, frankly, we print much less than we see online, those monitors are getting really high resolution. And so if we already have a monitor that's 5K and 15.3 megapixels, you know, I really wouldn't doubt that in 2-3 years, all those photos that you're shooting with that $7,000 camera won't even fill the screen.
Oh, I can almost guarantee it as well. I mean, they're already talking about 8K, 10K, and, you know, definitions that we wouldn't even really imagine on there. And that's where those higher end megapixel cameras are going to win out. So maybe that it's great that even like some of the mirrorless systems are shooting at higher end megapixels, and Nikon is catching on, or ahead of Canon, in my opinion, on having higher megapixel options at a lower price point. I mean, once you get into the D4S and the 1DX, it's kind of counterintuitive, but still, this is very exciting. And it's kind of making me a little bit scared because my 6D, I think, is 20.2 megapixels, and that's getting real close.
That's right. And like, are you going to have any problems with that while you're still shooting the 60? No. But don't you want your photos to look great 10 years from now? And so I don't know. For me personally, I really do think this is a big issue that a lot of photographers are skipping over. You know, for the hobbyist, you know, this is probably fine. It's not a big deal. But for professional photographers, especially a lot of photographers I know, their portfolio is their retirement. You know, they're going to be licensing photos for a lot of years to come. And you're going to want those photos to look great a lot of years from now. And so personally, I think it's a big deal.
Oh, it is. It's definitely going to make a huge impact as time goes on. But, you know, if I were to be a barometer for the future, I would say the higher megapixels, that's the way to go.
Yeah, that's for sure. And another interesting bit in the news was a football player came in at Ohio State and smashed a very, very expensive Canon lens, just smashed it right in half. Did you see that?
Yeah, I actually saw that, and it was crushed. It was broken in half. At first, I thought it just fell off of the camera, and it just looks like it took a bounce. But it just split it in half. A football player, I'm not sure if it was. It said OU in the article. If it's Oklahoma or Ohio State, sorry, one of us is right on it, but I'm not sure. But he just was going off the south. The football player was going off the southwest corner of the field, and you know, was just doing what a football player does. And he ran into a gentleman who had a monopod, and the lens just split in half. So The university has decided that not just photographers, even event staff will no longer be allowed to be in that tarp area on the southwest corner of the field due to this incident and probably some other incidents that have led up to this. But, you know, it goes back to that story we were talking about with basketball players crowding along the baseline there. I mean, we're talking about people that weigh hundreds of pounds. Football players are covered in hard gear to protect their bodies. I mean, a football helmet slamming into a camera, I don't care what kind of lens you have, it's probably going to make a dent or break it in half, as we saw in this story.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's that was an expensive shoot for this guy. I feel bad, but I hope he got some cool shots before it happened, at least.
Yeah, and it wasn't really the publicity he was hoping for, but at least, you know, it brings some awareness to, you know, the positions we put ourselves in as photographers.
Yeah. Well, in every episode, we want to share a doodad of the week, and mine this week is the Really Right Stuff L plate. I mentioned in a previous podcast that I switched to the Really Right Stuff ball head. Now, when you do that, it will hurt your pocketbook. It is an expensive ball head at around $400, but I keep going through ball heads, and I thought, okay, so many people recommend the Really Right Stuff. I'm going to try it, and, you know, really with a ball head, there are a lot of great ball heads out there. Its job is hold camera steady and be easy to use. That's it. And so there are a lot of them that I've been happy with, but I keep burning through them. You know, they break, parts fall out, kind of get, you know, a little bit loose over time. And so I have to buy another. I've been through quite a few ball heads. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to try the Really Right Stuff for a couple of years and we'll see how long it lasts. If it really does last forever or if I'm just going to burn through an expensive ball head now. So the jury's out, but I love the ball head. I mean, it's so cool. It's awesome. It's very, very well built. But along with that ball head, you can get an L plate. An L plate is a metal bracket that goes under your camera and off to the left side. So not the side that you hold, but the other side of the camera. And it kind of turns that corner. It just turns 90 degrees, a piece of metal that turns 90 degrees there. And what it is it has a tripod mount on both the bottom and the left side. So when you want to shoot a vertical, you don't have to turn your ball head into that little groove and hang your camera off to the side of the ball head. You keep the camera centered above the ball head, which makes it a little bit more stable. And also, it's just so much quicker to go into vertical orientation. I found myself switching, you know, landscape orientation and vertical orientation, portrait orientation, much more often since I got the L plate, because it's just a lot easier to do. So I can highly recommend it, the Really Right Stuff L plate. They make it for just about every camera model out there. And other brands make L plates as well. And I haven't tested them. They may be just fine. But I just happen to be using the Really Right Stuff L plate because I'm using their ball head. But definitely something to check out. If you shoot a lot of landscapes, it's pretty convenient, more convenient than I expected it to be. For a lot of years, I've just been, you know, dipping down into that groove in the ball head. But now, I don't know if I could go back.
Right on. And I'm shooting with a Manfrotto tripod and a Manfrotto ball head currently, probably like a lot of the audience that's listening. But my doodad of the week is actually the Black Rapid Fasten RT1, and it's actually just abbreviated as the FR-T1. It's a replacement for the Manfrotto RC2 release plate that goes into the tripod, and it allows you to change the way you're shooting from shooting on a monopod, shooting on a tripod, or shooting handheld real quickly. Essentially, you're just popping out the screw that goes into the bottom of your camera's body and replacing it with one made by Black Rapid, and then it enables you to hang your camera from that hook there, so you never have to take the plate off your camera, and you can easily screw it onto a monopod or put it back onto your Manfrotto tripod. I actually learned about it at a camera store when I was shooting the Breeze and my dad was picking up that 24-70 Tamron we were talking about earlier. So it's a really cool device, and it seems like both of these kind of share a similar theme of being able to easily change your orientation and composition without having to go through a bunch of extra unnecessary steps.
Very cool. Well, that does it for this week. Thank you for your download and your support of Improved Photography, and we'll see you in a couple days.
Thanks. Bye-bye.